to the third case of the morning, McAllister v. Price. Mr. Clark.
Good morning, Your Honors. Matthew Clark on behalf of Jerry Price in his individual capacity. If it may please the Court. Your Honor, we're here today on an appeal with respect to a qualified immunity issue. The District Court denied the summary judgment with respect to Officer Price in his individual capacity. We believe as a matter of law that the District Court erred in this judgment, and we're seeking the reversal and entry of summary judgment on Officer Price's claims. With respect to Officer Price, we contend that plaintiff failed to meet his burden in this case and defeat the qualified immunity defense, in that Price's actions were reasonable all times and do not constitute a constitutional violation. In addition, we believe that the even if a constitutional violation may be impacted here, we do not believe that Officer Price was on notice that his actions would violate the Constitution and therefore entitled to qualified immunity. We believe that the force used by Officer Price, as described by Witness Barden, of physically extricating from him the vehicle, taking him to the ground with both hands, and then handcuffing him, is reasonable as a matter of law, based on the undisputed facts. After the facts in this case, as related in the briefs, indicate that Officer Price was sent by dispatch to determine whether or not there had been a motor vehicle accident involving an intoxicated driver. He arrived on this.
They come as a shock, but we've read all the briefs.
Very good, Your Honor. I appreciate that. But we do view that all the undisputed facts lead to a reasonable amount of force used in this case, that under the Smith v. Ball State case specifically, that the actions described in that case by this court were similar to the nature of what took place in this case, that involved a diabetic driver, that force was used to extricate him from the vehicle, and it was used. Therefore, we believe that all of Officer Price's actions were reasonable as a matter of law based on the severity of the crime, a suspected intoxicated driver that had caused a multi-car accident, based on the immediate threat of the safety to the officer and the public safety. Officer Price was on a busy intersection. Car accident had just been caused. When Mr. McAllister went to reach for his gear shift, he reasonably believed that he was going to pull away, and therefore he took action. With respect to the law, with respect to use of force, it's clear that it's based on the officer's perspective, not to employ 20/20 hindsight. We as officers make split-second decisions, and qualified immunity defense allows for reasonable mistakes, and to the extent there was any with respect to a perception as to whether or not Mr. McAllister was an intoxicated driver or a diabetic driver, that mistake would have been a reasonable one, allowing for qualified immunity. In addition, as indicated in the brief, the district court had found a question of fact with respect to the hip injury caused in this case, that we believe as a matter of law that the hip injury should not have been considered because the doctor or the plaintiff's treating physician indicated that he could not tell within a probability that the force used by Officer Price caused the hip injury itself. Therefore, we think that the plaintiff failed to meet his burden with establishing that evidence, and therefore should not have been considered by the district court. If so, then the district court, we believe, as a matter of law, improperly found a question of fact with respect to that hip injury issue. With respect to, in essence, we believe that the plaintiff and the court essentially bootstrapped that argument that because there was a hip injury, therefore there must have been too much force used. We asked the court to take a look at the amount of force used and that it's similar than the Smith versus Ball State case, and therefore we believe that summary judgment would be appropriate, either on the basis that there was no constitutional violation or on the fact that Officer Price wasn't on notice that his actions might violate his constitutional rights. If you have any questions.
I do have a question for you, and I'm going to mispronounce the name of this case, I'm sure. The Abdullahi versus City of Madison case,
yes.
The officer kneeling on the back of the person being restrained. What does that case do for you?
Your Honor, I think in that case that, as I recall, with respect to that matter, that there had been a knee on the back that caused a death in this case, or in that case. Similarly, in the Caitlin case, there had been a knee in the back in which summary judgment was granted. So I don't think the actual application of the knee on the back alone resolves in a question of fact, but rather we need to look at the different gram factors, the severity of the crime, the threat to public safety, and so forth. So I don't think that case dictates an outcome in this case, Your Honor.
But you've got a witness here saying that your client was placing the full force of his weight in the hip area of plaintiff's back, and the full force of his weight.
That's correct, Your Honor. Again, I don't think that's sufficient as far as the hip injury is concerned. I don't think that evidence alone is sufficient to create a genuine issue of material fact. I think the plaintiff had just been in a car accident traveling 55 miles an hour. Plaintiff's treating physician said the accident or the hip injury could have resulted from the fall. Mr. McAllister did get up from the ground and walk to the tailgate. He did go to the EMTs where he didn't report any pain, and his leg was ambulatory at the time, according to the emergency medical technician, Wesley.
And did you mean to say it could have occurred as a result of the fall?
That's
there's
correct.
No fall here. He's thrown to the ground. Isn't he?
That's true, according to Mr. Barton's testimony. That's true, Your Honor. But, again, I don't think that results in a denial of summary judgment. Similar in the Smith versus Ball State case, where the plaintiff was physically taken from the vehicle and taken down the ground. The officer in that case tried to apply a knee strike and wound up doing a group tackle. And in that case, summary judgment was granted based on qualified immunity.
Now, the force complained of here relates to the removal of the car from the car and throwing to the ground.
Correct.
If there's some evidence about the cuffs being too tight, is that part of the claim of excessive force?
Your Honor, that was never specifically ruled upon in the district court, and was not my understanding that it was part of the force claim. To the extent it is, I think handcuffs were reasonable, as was used in the Smith versus Ball State case. In addition, while Mr. Barton did testify that he thought the cuffs were too tight, another witness also indicated that there had only been a scratch. The cuffs were removed as soon as Officer Price determined or found out that Mr. McAllister was a diabetic. So his actions were reasonable at all times.
All right. You want to reserve a little time, Mr. Clark?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Harper? Thank you, Mr. Clark.
Good morning, Your Honors. I would like to address first the issue of the hip injury. I would, of course, point out that on a motion for summary judgment, which this court is well aware, the facts are to be construed in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, in this case, Mr. McAllister.
Right. And maybe you can help me on this, too. And
sure.
The excessive force that's at the heart of your case, is it related to the hip, or does it include the handcuffs? What does it involve?
It includes from our perspective, it is the totality of the circumstances. It includes the hip. It includes the bruised lung. It includes the bleeding from the wrists. It's looking at the facts in the totality in terms of the threat posed, whether Mr. McAllister was resisting, the factors considered in the issue of whether there was reasonable force used. I think most importantly here that I would like to point out is there's an issue with regard to that's been raised by the appellant, whether the hip injury was as a result of the automobile collision or whether the hip injury was as a result of the officer forcibly removing Mr. McAllister from the vehicle, throwing him to the ground, and then bringing his knee down onto his lower back with the full force of his body weight. I would like to point out what the record shows, what the facts are before the district court and this court. This was a property damage only accident. There were no personal injuries involved. In fact, two of the witnesses, Mr. Tack and Mr. Barden, were the two witnesses to the altercation, were the two gentlemen whose vehicles were damaged as a result of this collision. They were out and about watching what was going on at the time of the altercation with the officer. According to Mr. Barden, Mr. McAllister's vehicle slightly bumped his vehicle into the back. Mr. McAllister testified that he was not in any pain following the automobile collision. The inside of Mr. McAllister's vehicle was undamaged. The collision itself was not even severe enough to cause the airbags to deploy. Mr. Price, Officer Price, forcibly removed Mr. McAllister from the vehicle, grabbing his arm, yanking him out.
Weren't there other accidents before the one you're describing?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Weren't there other collisions before the one you're describing?
There were two collisions immediately preceding the altercation with the officer.
I'm talking about what the officer knew when he got there. So he knew that this was the third in a series of collisions.
There were only two.
Well, but there were reports from other drivers about the erratic driving.
Right.
There were.
So that came in on the 911 as well.
Yes.
So how is an officer to distinguish when he comes to the scene with this car still running, the guy behind the wheel, distinguish between the problems posed by a diabetic and someone who, say, as they say, blind drunk, with the car still running, not responding to commands to turn the car off, get out of the vehicle, those types of things?
I would say a couple things. The testimony of Mr. Barden is that when he arrived at the scene, well, he was at the scene, and when Officer Price arrived at the scene, Mr. McAllister was seated in his vehicle. He was visibly twitching. He was convulsing, staring off into space. Mr. Barden, who was the closest witness of all of the witnesses to the altercation with the officer, testified that he did not believe that Mr. McAllister appeared to be drunk in any way whatsoever. He appeared to Mr. Barden to have something medically going on with him. I would also point out that Mrs. Draves, who is another witness to this, further corroborated the testimony of Mr. Barden when she said that Mr. McAllister's hands were twitching, in addition to Mr. Barden, who said he was visibly convulsing. So what Officer Price was presented with was a wholly different set of circumstances, which would not, if to a reasonable officer, appear to be a drunk driver.
Mr. Harper,
you go ahead.
Mr. McAllister was seated in the car with his seatbelt on, and the record indicates Mr. Price removed him. Does it indicate who released him from that seatbelt?
The record is unclear as to when the seatbelt was removed. From my perspective, from what I have read and my involvement in the case, there is ambiguity in terms of whether Officer Price removed the seatbelt or whether Mr. McAllister did. Based on the facts that I understand, I would doubt that Mr. McAllister did, given his condition.
But your claim is an excessive force claim. It's not a claim of deliberate indifference to Mr. McAllister's knee.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So the question is whether the removal from the car was done in with excessive force.
That's correct, Your Honor.
You don't dispute that, or maybe you do, that the officer had a duty to get the guy out of the car and to turn the car off.
Not at all. The issue is based on the totality of the circumstances, whether the amount of force used was reasonable or unreasonable. Given the facts as presented to Officer Price, forcibly removing an elderly gentleman from his vehicle.
Wait a minute. He's younger than I am.
Well, this is according
to the
This is according to one of the witnesses.
Well, but he was only 58 at the time, I think.
Mrs. Draves testified that it appeared to her that he was elderly. He had many morbid conditions. He was diabetic. He had COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease.
A bit of the problem here is that we're getting some opinions from bystanders who aren't law enforcement officers, and what we need to look at is from the on-the-scene perspective of the law enforcement officer, not a 20/20 hindsight or not what a bystander might opine. That's one of the problems here.
Well, and I believe what the independent witnesses saw is evidence of what Mr. Price saw when he was on scene as well, and should be used in considering what he was seeing at the time this occurred, as opposed to looking at this 20/20, knowing that he was diabetic.
Is it your position, Mr. Harper, that Officer Price should have reached in and turned off the ignition? Or?
I don't believe that would have been unreasonable in any respect.
It's a pretty risky move by a police officer to reach into a vehicle across the suspect with your weaponry and radios and so forth right there exposed to that person.
Whether he had done that or whether he didn't do that, I would not believe that to be an unreasonable action on the part of the police officer. What we take issue with is the amount of force used, given the totality of the circumstances, in forcibly yanking this man out of the vehicle, throwing him to the ground, coming down onto his lower back with the full weight of his body, using his knee, breaking his hip. Our contention is whether he should have turned the ignition off or whether he did or whether that was an issue, I don't believe would have been reasonable or unreasonable in any way. For these reasons, I would ask that the court affirm the judgment of the trial court and deny the defendant's motion for summary judgment. All
right. Thank you, Mr. Harper. Mr. Clark?
Just a few things, Your Honor. Your Honors, as the court indicated, one of the concerns that an officer has on the job is protection for safety of himself and others. I think what this case causes...
Even against an old man at that age...
he was young and spry, Your Honor. In any event, I think that there has to be, and the law indicates that the officer's first duty is to the safety of the public at large and to extricate the driver from the vehicle, which he did in a reasonable manner.
Was there any exigent circumstances, Mr. Clark, which would cause him to have to act with great dispatch, that is, Officer Price, beyond just the normal arrival at an accident scene? I mean, would you suggest the record is clear on the amount of time the Officer Price invested in assessing the situation? Or do you feel that there just was such a condition surrounding this accident that he had to move in the fashion he did?
Well, I think the record reveals that Officer Price saw Mr. McAllister reaching for his gear shift. So I think as he reached for that gear shift, he determined that was time he had to take action. So I think the whole time frame was less than a minute, according to the record. But I think in this circumstances, he had to move at that time. And it wasn't a situation where he could possibly wait or take alternative means and methods or other uses of force. So based on the record, I think he did use a reasonable amount of force necessary to extricate Mr. McAllister from the vehicle. The record indicates even for Mr. Barton, he took him down with both hands and then he handcuffed him. I believe this case is very much similar to the Smith versus Ball State, in which summary judgment was granted on a qualified immunity basis. I certainly think that case alone would not put Officer Price on notice that any of his actions taken on March 1st, 2006 would violate Mr. McAllister's constitutional rights. I would request that the district court's denial of summary judgment be reversed and summary judgment be entered in his favor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Mr. Harper. The case is taken under advisement.